to see everybody here this morning. I really appreciate your presence today. And if you are a visitor meeting with us for the very first time, then please let us know whatever spiritual needs you have. We would love to sit down and discuss Bible matters with you and present to you the gospel of Jesus Christ in plain and simple terms that we can read straight from the Bible. So in February of this year, I did a lesson called In the Fullness of Time, and I was not able to fit it in the fullness of the time allotted. And I promised you at the end of that lesson that I would come back to it and wrap things up. And then I forgot. So here we are now in September, and we're going to do part two. So if you do not remember the first half of this lesson, or if you didn't live here in Phoenix or were not a member at Monte Vista, I encourage you to go to our website and refresh your memory there. Watch that sermon so you get the other part of it. In part one, basically what I did is I considered a scripture in the book of Galatians, in Galatians chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. And we talked about in that passage, there's a phrase there, in the fullness of time, or when the time was right. And we talked about from a biblical perspective, why is it that Jesus came when he did at that point in history from a biblical perspective? How was it that the ministry of Jesus was set up by the things that preceded it in the Old Testament? How did Moses set Jesus up? How did Abraham set Jesus up? What part did the law play? Or in Galatians chapter 3, the way that it describes the law as a tutor that led us to Jesus, what role did the law play in leading us to the Messiah? Now, what I want to do in this lesson is consider the historical perspective. Look a little bit more at secular history or culture or social situations in the first century. And what was it about the first century that made it the right time for Jesus to come then and not 1,000 years later or 1,000 years earlier? What was it about that time period that made it the fullness of time? Let's consider a couple things here. Have your Bibles open to John chapter 12. Because we see a story here in John chapter 12 that leads us to see that Jesus understood that the time was right for his ministry. The time was right for him to go to the cross and fulfill all things. And as he says in this passage, to be glorified by the Father. So in John chapter 12, and I want to read the whole context here so that we're all on the same page here. In John 12 and verse 20, notice the way he describes it here. Now there were certain Greeks or Gentiles among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These therefore came to Philip, who was one of Jesus' disciples, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee. And they began asking him, saying, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. Now, Philip came and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip came and they told Jesus. And Jesus said in verse 23, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. There was something about that. There was something that indicated to Jesus, this is the time. There's no more delaying. The time of the Son of Man has arrived. And there was something about those Gentiles coming so eagerly to see Jesus and learn at his feet that was an indication to Jesus. Verse 24, truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world shall keep it to life eternal. Verse 26, if anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall my servant also be. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. And I like the way that that plays a part in this text of being glorified and being honored. And if you want to follow Jesus, that is where the only honor and glory is to be found, at least the only honor and glory that means something in an eternal sense. Verse 27 now. Verse 27. And the tone shifts a little bit here in verse 27, doesn't it? And I think Jesus, a little more hushed now, says, now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? This is the whole culmination. This is the whole point of the ministry of Jesus. In a sense, you could take what was discussed in part one back in February, you could take those lessons and say, everything of the faith of Abraham that was looking forward to the blessing of the whole world in the seed of Abraham was culminating in this moment. The law was culminating, was leading up to this moment. The prophets, Jeremiah and Isaiah, what Daniel was looking forward to, prophesying about the Son of Man, the glory in the book of Ezekiel that he saw in prophetic language, dry bones coming back to life, all of that was leading up to this moment. So how could Jesus look at the suffering of that moment and say, I quit. I can't do it. I can't follow through with it. Father, save me from this hour. All of religious history has been leading up to this moment, and now I've got cold feet. Could I possibly say that, Jesus says? Could I possibly come to that conclusion? Everything has been leading up to this moment. So in the fullness of time, when it is the right time, when everything is ready to go, how could I possibly say, Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose, I came to this hour. So in verse 28, Father, glorify thy name. And there came a voice out of heaven, booming, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. Now the multitudes who stood by heard it, and they were saying that it had thundered. Others were saying, an angel has spoken to him. But Jesus said in verse 30, this voice has not come for my sake, but for yours. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. And that's a reference back to Isaiah chapter 2 and other passages as well. There was something about this moment where Jesus realized, if he had not realized it already, that is, but there was something about this moment that indicated to Jesus, this is it. Everything that we've been working up to is happening right now. This is the moment where salvation is being initiated. And it would not be long past this moment that Judas would betray him, that the Lord's Supper would commence, that he would pray in the garden, not my will, but your will. That he would face the chief priests, they would spit upon him and beat him, bring him before Pilate and say, crucify him, crucify him, and that Pilate would write his death certificate. It was not long after this that he would endure the pain and the suffering on the cross. And only a couple days later, he would be raised from the dead so that sin and death could be defeated. And that, my friends, that is the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ in a nutshell. But like I said, I want to consider what it was about this time period that made it right. In Romans 5, verse 6, Paul notes that Christ died at the right time. So what were the social conditions? What were the political conditions? What was the condition of the Jews in the diaspora? What was the condition of the Gentiles? What was it about the first century AD that made it the right time for the Messiah to come and bring the gospel to fruition? Why not 1,000 years earlier? Why not 1,000 years later? Well, let's consider some of these things. First of all, think about the Romans themselves and everything that the Romans had going for them and everything that they had accomplished up to that point. Now, only 100 years earlier, the Roman Republic was in complete disarray. There was civil war, there were factions, there was fighting. But in the first century AD, they had reached a point that was typically called the Pax Romana, which means the Roman peace, where all they wanted was peace. That was what they cared about more than anything else, was peace and quiet within the Roman Empire. That's what they wanted, the Pax Romana. And even though there were still periods of upheaval for the rest of their history, and there were periods of upheaval even in the first century, It's not like the time period of Nero was the most peaceful, and there was even one year where there were four emperors in succession, one right after the other, getting assassinated and replaced by somebody else. So yes, there were periods of upheaval, but compared to the first century BC, or even a couple hundred years after the first century, the first century AD was a very peaceful time in the Roman Empire. Not only that, but everything that the Romans had accomplished in terms of society and culture and politics and commerce, they had thousands of miles of roads, roads that certainly you and I wouldn't want to drive on today, but for that time period were considered very modern, very efficient roads. They had a postal system, a very efficient postal system, so that you could communicate from one end of the empire to the other end within just a matter of a few days. They had a very organized political system as well, so that even in the far-flung provinces, there was a police system, there was a judicial system, there were Roman legions stationed out there to keep the peace. So there were a lot of things about the Roman time period in the first century that made it just perfect for the gospel message to come. In fact, when the Romans conquered the Greeks a few hundred years earlier, they adopted many of the Greek customs, many of the things that made the Greeks very admirable. They realized that in conquering the Greeks, they are actually inheriting from the Greeks things that were superior to their own systems, the political systems, for example, and the Greek language. And the Romans essentially adopted Koine Greek because it was such an amazing language. And speaking of the language, of Koine or common, that's what the word Koine means, common Greek, it was a familiar and uniform language. It was well suited to be written. It was well suited to be transcribed. It was well suited to be communicated to other people. And it was exact beyond our own language. And you think about in the English language, the way that we've borrowed so many words, and we basically just kind of cobbled together several different languages. We're sort of a hybrid of Germanic and Romantic languages with a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And our language changes. It seems like every few years or so, there's new words being introduced and old words being tossed aside. Well, Koine Greek was not the same way. It was a very precise, very exact language. So if you were going to translate the Hebrew Bible into a language that was common for all people, Koine Greek was perfect. If you were going to write the New Testament, letters to churches, if you were going to write gospel stories about Jesus Christ and expect that a mass audience would be able to receive it and understand it, Koine Greek was your language. And that language was there and available across the entire Roman Empire. And even though people still spoke their own local languages, almost everybody had some understanding of Koine Greek in the entire Roman Empire. But there were social situations that also made it so that the gospel could be accepted at this time more readily than perhaps any time before it. Take slavery, for example. In Romans chapter 6, when it talks about slavery, where you're either enslaved to God or you're enslaved to sins, that would have been a message that resonated with people across the entire Roman Empire. Perhaps 40% of the entire population was slaves. Think about that. Perhaps 40% of the entire Roman population in the empire were slaves. So to talk about slavery was something that almost any common person would understand because they either were slaves or had been slaves at some point in the past and earned enough money to buy their freedom, and they were then considered freedmen. Or they were Roman citizens who owned slaves. Slavery permeated culture. And it wasn't just that they were slaves working out in fields. It wasn't just that they were slaves living in hovels or being beaten and abused all the time. In Roman society, slaves actually held a number of different positions within the household. And more often than not, and a number of historical commentators have made this point, but more often than not, the slaves in a household were smarter, better educated, and knew what was going on more than their masters did. While the masters were luxuriating, it was the slaves who were running the household. Accountants, physicians, These were often slaves. A household physician was often one of the slaves. The one who ran the household, the one who kept the books, the one who knew where all the money was coming from, business managers. These were often slaves in a household, and they knew more about what was going on than their own masters did. So what you had was a huge population of educated, well-informed, yet socially humble individuals where the message of freedom would resonate with them very loudly. Can you see where I'm going with this? Well-educated, well-informed people where the message of freedom would resonate with them, that is a perfect audience to receive the gospel message. A perfect audience to receive the gospel message. But there's some other things as well. Morality in Roman culture was typically not connected to religion. Religion and morals were two very different things. The morals in the Roman Empire were often dictated by the whims of the emperor at the time. The first emperor, named Augustus, was an extremely moral man. He was a moralizer of all moralizers. In fact, he was the sort of person that when a poet named Ovid wrote a rather racy book about basically a how-to guide on committing adultery, Augustus had Ovid banished from the Roman Empire for writing a racy book about adultery. Augustus did not tolerate that sort of thing in his own household, and he even had his own daughter banished from the empire when he found out that she had committed adultery. Now, that was under Augustus. But when emperors changed hands, when you go from one emperor to another, the morality of the emperor tended to dictate the morality of the empire. That wasn't so in religion. They did not consider religion to be a part of their morals. For the Romans, religion was a political thing as much as anything else. For them, it was honoring and worshiping the state, honoring and worshiping the emperor himself, honoring and worshiping the gods or the forefathers. To them, morality and religion were not connected to each other. So when Christianity comes on the scene and it connects the divine, the spiritual, with the moral, that was a revolutionary message. That God, the only God, cares about how you live, was a powerful message to them. And they had never heard something like that before. To think that spirituality and morality were connected by these fibers deep within us, that changed a lot of people. That affected a lot of people. It was intriguing to a lot of people. But in the Roman Empire, there was also a real contempt for life. Among the Romans, abortion, suicide, and divorce were very common. The bloodlust in the arena, the gladiatorial combat, the way that people were executed in the Colosseum and the other forums, that showed to me an indication of Rome's low estimation of human worth. That if you failed the empire in some way, you were killed. If you failed your master in some way, you were killed. If you didn't show your allegiance to the emperor in some way, you were killed. If you were worthless in any way to the empire, you were killed. And not just killed, but killed in exotic ways. Killed in fantastic ways. What they would do in the Colosseum, in fact, there was one time where the Colosseum, trees were planted, a forest was planted inside the Colosseum. And what they would have them do is they would have great heroes from their mythology. They would replay the stories of the tragic deaths of their great heroes from mythology. But of course, the great heroes were always played by criminals and slaves and worthless people, and they would release lions and tigers and other wild animals into the forest, and 50,000 people in the Colosseum would watch these people get hunted down right before their eyes in this little fake forest. Things like that. Exotic ways of killing people. But abortion was also very common. Abortion was also very common. So when the gospel message comes in and says that you are actually worth something, that you are worth something, that you might be a slave and you might be poor and you might be in debt and you might even be a criminal, a convict, but you are worth something to God, That message was incredibly powerful to people. But it also showed how much they needed to change. You could read 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 through 10 as an example, where the Corinthians had a lot they needed to change about their lives. And they were primarily Gentiles in that congregation. And they were adulterers. And they were drunkards. And they were liars. And they were thieves. And they were homosexuals. But they were washed. They were sanctified and justified. And I think that would resonate with those people. But there was also an acceptance of new religion, because for political reasons, Rome allowed religious freedom throughout their provinces. As long as you were obedient to the empire, as long as you paid your taxes and didn't cause any mischief, you could believe whatever you wanted. Believe in any gods that you want to keep your local religion, that's fine. We don't care, was the Romans' attitude, as long as you don't cause any mischief. So for Christianity to come along, they were accepted for the most part. Now, I know that history shows that people like Nero and Domitian, they had their issues with Christians, but oftentimes those issues were localized. They were localized to either Rome itself, like under Nero. Nero did not have any kind of national or empire-wide persecution against Christians. It was local primarily to the city of Rome itself. For the most part, throughout its history, Christianity existed in the Roman Empire with relative peace and quiet, for the most part. But there were other things, not just about the Romans themselves. Let's consider the first century Jews. In the ministry of Jesus, it really resonated with people because his message was different. It says in Matthew chapter 7, verses 28 and 29, that the people were just clamoring to listen to his message. That his message was special and unique to them because he spoke as one having authority and not like their scribes. There was something different about the message of Jesus that just affected people in a way that the scribes and Pharisees' message was not affecting them. I remember in Matthew chapter 23, where Jesus is criticizing the Pharisees for being hypocrites. He talks about the way that you might travel, you'll travel the globe looking for just one convert, right? And you end up converting one person with all of this effort. You end up making him more a slave to sin and the devil than he was before. You know, with all that effort, it's like they could convert one person to their way. Jesus comes along and he preaches a simple message, and he has the multitudes clamoring after him, following after him. They flock to John the Baptist's message of repentance. People from all over Jerusalem and Judea, according to Matthew chapter 3, they were coming to be baptized by John the Baptist. And there was also a heightened sense of messianic expectation. People felt like this could be it. This could be the moment. This Jesus of Nazareth, there's something about him. The people were ready to hear the message. They might not have been ready 100 years earlier. It might not have been the right time 1,000 years earlier. But at the right time, Christ came. The diaspora. The diaspora is just a fancy word for dispersion, right? When something is spread out. And that's just a typical terminology for the condition of the Jews in the first century, where because of being repeatedly conquered by the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the life that they lived in Babylonian and Persian captivity, the Jews had been spread out throughout the known world. And there were encampments of Jews. There were small communities of Jews in almost every city in the entire Roman Empire, from what we would consider to be modern-day Iran to modern-day Spain down into northern Africa, there were communities of Jews in almost every town and almost every city in the Roman Empire. So people like Paul and Barnabas and Silas and Timothy could go to almost any corner of the Roman Empire and have a built-in audience that knew the Scriptures, that knew God, that had a messianic expectation, and because of their conversations with Jews in Judea, might already be aware of Jesus of Nazareth and what he had done during his ministry. So that built-in audience made it possible for the apostles and other Christians in that time period to go to almost any corner of the empire and have kind of a ready-made audience to present the gospel. And the last point is this. Not only were the Jews in the first century receptive to the message, but the Gentiles were as well, which brings us full circle. We looked in John chapter 12 at the beginning of our lesson, where some Greeks or Gentiles come to the disciples of Jesus saying, "We would really like to hear this message. We want to meet Jesus. We are eager to meet Jesus." And that right there, that was an indication to Jesus that the time is now. This is it. That moment to Jesus was kind of the initiating moment when the gospel would come to fruition. I remember a Syrophoenician woman that really wanted to hear the message. There were Gentiles who cared. There were Gentiles who were receptive. In Mark chapter 7, 26, the Syrophoenician came to Jesus. In Matthew chapter 12, verses 15 through 21, Jesus is quoting from Isaiah 42 and even referencing Isaiah chapter 2 and Isaiah chapter 9. There was something about the Gentiles seeking Him at that moment that indicated that the time was at hand. And in the book of Acts, when the Philippian jailer heard about the gospel. In the book of Acts, when the centurion Cornelius heard about the gospel. Those kinds of people were ready and willing to listen and accept. Truly, truly, at the right time, both in the context of the broader story of the Bible, of the law and the promises to Abraham, as well as in the context of human history, it was the right time for Christ to come. The coming of Jesus and the gospel coming to fruition, there was not a plan B, it was not an accident, it was not an afterthought, it was not something that Jesus and God came up with kind of like at the last second, we've got to slap something together right now. They didn't delay it, they didn't ignore it, they didn't forget about it. At the right time, in every way, culturally and socially and politically, at the right time Christ came. God had a plan. And when God has a plan, that plan always, always works out. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You have an opportunity right now to make whatever spiritual need that you have known to God and to us as well. So if there's anything at all that we can do for you of a spiritual nature, then please let it be known by coming forward as we